Hi there. This is Amy Reitnauer Jacobs, co-founder and executive director of The Bluegrass Situation. BGS started in Los Angeles and has always been proud to call it home. With the recent wildfire devastation in Altadena and the Palisades, so many members of our roots music community have lost everything. With more difficult days ahead, we now focus on rebuilding and continuing to support the artists and creators who make Los Angeles and the surrounding area so special. Please visit thebluegrasssituation.com/LAfires to find ways you can help our musical community when they need us most. Thanks.
Hi, and welcome to Basic Folk, where we have honest conversations with folk musicians on the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network. If you have not heard the news, maybe you're like, blah, I have heard the news. It's a 24-hour news cycle. I've definitely heard this news. Sorry, skip ahead the next 10 to 15 seconds. But Basic Folk is now an official production of The Bluegrass Situation.
Da-ba-da-da!
I'm Cindy Howes, here with Lizzie Ngo on the podcast.
A new day has come. I'm so sorry. Celine Dion just popped by.
Wow.
To give me a little gas up for the day. I'm doing great. I have a fever.
And the only cure is?
Likely ibuprofen, but a backup would be folk music.
Yay. Oh, hooray. I'm sorry you don't feel well. Yuck.
That's okay. Don't you think that like the fact that I went on tour for a whole year without getting significantly sick once means that I was due for this?
You must have incredible antibodies. Yeah, girl.
Thank you. Did you hear that, guys? I have an incredible body. How are you?
I just want to close my eyes for like 3 months.
Well, 2025 is going to be a big year, so get your naps in now.
So what I do now is I go to Goodwill and I buy things. Like I bought this mug, the Alamo.
Do you want to see something that I've got?
Oh, yes. Please, Lizzie, explain to the listeners what you are holding.
I might not be a mom, but I do have a Stanley Cup. I have been joking about wanting a Stanley Cup for months, and I went into an Urban Outfitters, no joke, like 3 months ago to buy one because I saw them in the window, and then I found out they're like $60, $70, and
oh
I was like,
God.
Absolutely not.
For a cup?
For a mug, but then I just mentioned it at my show, at my last show of the year in Atlanta. And someone in the audience was like, you can have mine. And I was like, are you kidding me? You're so sweet. You're an angel. And she just gave me this. I'm holding up like a really elegant off-white Stanley
Cup. Yeah, look at our two cups.
Cheers.
Whose do you prefer? Mine says the Alamo, San Antonio, Texas.
Shout out to Margot Silker. I remember the Alamo. Ooh. I don't participate in the redacted streaming service Wrapped. You know what I'm talking about. And I won't promote that evil corporation, but they did let me know that my number one listened to song of 2024 was Lowland Trail by Margot Silker.
Oh,
and I was like,
right,
I know that's fucking right because I have been climbing a mountain as we all have, like, ooh, looking for my Lowland Trail.
You know what mine was?
Tell me.
Mine was Lizzie Ngo, Annie Oakley.
Stop that. Stop that.
Also, I want to say for the record that I did not have Spotify Wrapped. I had a Tidal year in review or whatever they're calling it. I also have Spotify just for like work, you know, because it's annoying to not have a Spotify account if you're like working in music.
Yeah, people use it a lot for sharing new music, but it's really not great in terms of sound quality and artist payouts, just to fill in some of those blanks for our listeners.
And user experience also blows. And this year, the Spotify Wrapped was out of control. It was fucking ridiculous.
The graphics were really, really unsightly. Can we talk about that? Like, who is doing... Does anyone work there anymore?
One guy. I thought, like, the Spotify Wrapped this year was, like... Like, okay, so you're a big baseball fan, like you're a serious baseball fan, and you want to go watch a baseball game. Fenway Park is a real ass baseball field.
True.
Pittsburgh, God bless PNC Park, it is not a real baseball stadium. Like,
God bless.
You're watching the pierogi race, You know, it there's like games in between every inning. They're showing like Looney Tunes on the big screen. Like that's what it felt like. Spotify Wrapped was like.
Like super fun? What are you talking about?
Just like stupid, dumb entertainment that's like taking away from like the seriousness and the emotional depth of music.
But the way that I feel about it is like, let's take that a little bit further, because if I were at a game, seeing a pierogi race would delight me and it would be a nice little interlude. Spotify Wrapped is like if the Pittsburgh Parrot mascot also was taking 70% of your income. Of the players on the field.
And it
was not a real person. And it was doing a little dance on the field. Meanwhile, the players are like literally on Medicaid, struggling to pay their bills. Like, can I even make it back next season? But the parrot's just dancing around like, I've got all your money. And like, here's a little puppet show I made. Wow, that's how Lizzie, I feel about Spotify Wrapped.
You just took it to a new level. Anyways, can we all just fucking quit Spotify and get on Tidal or like go buy an old tape deck from the Goodwill?
Let's do all the above. We literally have so much to talk about. Can I intro our incredible guest? I'm so glad that they're one of our first guests of 2025.
Yes. First of all, I just want to say that there's a bunch of links in the show notes where you can like sign up for our newsletter, follow us on social media and make a contribution so that we don't go flat broke making this podcast. So please check the link in the show notes or go to basicfolk.com. Thank you.
I am going to keep this introduction short because Lutalo's music speaks for itself. One of the most exciting things for me as the co-host of this show is getting to notice and be in conversation with upcoming trends in folk music. And I feel that there is a new generation of folk artists coming out. People like Lutalo, people like Hannah Francis, people that are like really dedicated to their craft, making new types of folk music. They're genre agnostic. They're making really cool songs and they're making waves. That's kind of all I want to say about Lutalo. Like, they could be compared to so many legendary artists and bands, and like, you can't quite put your finger on what their sound is, but they are a heavy hitting songwriter and I think they're going to be huge.
Lutalo released a record last year, and we're going to check out a clip of the song Summit Hill, and then we'll get to our conversation with Lizzino and Lutalo on Basic Folk.
Put about our children line, held the shell of a snail near their eye, crumbled soul on hollow ground, swallowed paper conscious of frown. In the cold on winter's night, kiss of gold with pale green light, coming tongue. Oh, when it comes, then it comes. Oh, when it comes, then it comes. Oh, when it comes.
Lutalo, welcome to Basic Folk.
Thank you for having me.
I am so happy to be talking with you. I have been really absorbing and meditating on your debut album, The Academy. And I want to start with your musical roots as we begin our conversation. Influence can be a million different things. A band you loved as a kid that inspired you to pick up an instrument, a mentor, visual art that inspires you, your favorite poem, a social movement, family lore, on and on and on. So when you think about your influences as a musical artist, what comes to mind?
Well, yeah, I would say my main musical influence off the bat was my father. He introduced me to pretty much just music in general and just a deep love for artistry and creativity. He was always very intentional about songwriting, or like presenting songwriting, lyricism, and having a creative output that felt genuine to whatever artist that we were listening to respectively. So I feel like that was my main introduction. Following that, pretty early on, he it would bring me to like these African drumming classes, African dance Whoa. Classes as well. And it would be just a line of people drumming and then a group of women doing traditional African dancing. And that was pretty much the base of everything that has led up to what I've been able to start identifying with in music now. So, yeah.
Wow. Okay. I was not expecting to get just such a juicy answer. But I feel like you hear all of those roots in your music in the way that it makes you want to move your body and in the sense of the we and the collective, but we can get to that later.
Yeah.
Who were some of the artists that your dad like really made sure to introduce you to?
Yeah. Well, he was really, really deep into the underground hip hop scene in his youth. So he would be at a lot of ciphers and organizations sort of like rap battles and such that were happening in the Minneapolis.
And where in the world are we talking?
This is Minneapolis.
Oh, Minneapolis.
Yeah, that's right.
Great.
So he had a whole crew that he ran with. He has old VHS footage of these rap ciphers that he'd show us and explain to us like the traditional like movement and rule sets and kind of just like how it was organized and functioned.
Whoa. Wait, yeah. For the listeners, mm-hmm. Can you briefly explain the pillars of hip hop?
Oh, I mean, I don't know if I'm fully qualified for that, but I can explain.
No one is. This is yeah. basic folk. We use our own opinions about genre.
Yeah. So I know that there's emceeing, there's mm-hmm. Breakdancing, and then there is, I guess, graffiti art as yes. well. And so mm-hmm. around those three pillars, I think it's
and just... DJing.
And DJing, thank you. That was it mm-hmm. as well, yeah.
And for some, education, political awareness.
Yes.
Sorry,
yes.
Go
oh,
on.
No, exactly. Well, that was the base framing of how my dad presented hip-hop
yeah.
to me was...
I love this.
That if it was not from a collective like uprising and mm-hmm. move like cultural movement, then it was not of substance. So he was just a traditional like hip hop head, you know, old hip hop
okay.
head.
Say
there,
less.
There's plenty of situations where he'd be like, "Oh, this person's whack. They don't actually like scratching is not just DJing or like this. Like people are like the culture at that time period was starting to get." Heavily rooted in capitalism and shifting. Yeah. So he was hypercritical of those things, and thus I became hypercritical. And so I apply that kind of criticism to a lot of art that I'm mm-hmm. engaging with currently as well, and that is the same kind of pass that I have to have with my own art as well. So even though I'm making alternative like rock or hip-hop or like folk or acoustic music, whatever, mm-hmm. it's all through the same kind of cultural lens, to me at least, of just I'm still making a form of hip hop just in different
yeah.
connotation, you know? So, yeah, at these ciphers, yeah, he would be filming and show me just some of like, there's even like body movements of like kind of like rocking back and forth to signify that even though we are coming at each other with lyricism doesn't mean that we need to come at each other physically violently. This
exactly.
is a way to communicate and express and in a nonviolent way. So
yeah, and in a way like that there are so many parallels in the folk tradition in the sense that a cipher is a ritual of conflict and resolution and competition. Like these are safe and ritualized spaces for like not only for people to battle it out, but for all of the audience, like not audience, it's the community.
The community
like, there's a connection
yeah.
between the people inside and outside the cipher, which I think resonates really deeply with how I relate to folk music. What are your earliest memories of singing in front of people? And have you always been comfortable doing that?
No, honestly, I would sing a lot in my own private moments. And whenever I did mm-hmm. sing in front of other people, especially outside of like my family, I was often told that I could not sing very well. And I wasn't one to dispute that. I was just like, yeah, fair enough. I don't have like a conventional voice. I remember singing to like an old, like singing in front of like an old ex, like my, like one of my first girlfriends in like middle school or something like that. And she just straight up told me that I could not sing and that I should not sing.
And, wait, did you continue going steady after that?
Well, yeah, I mean, I just kind of let stuff roll. I've always been one that just be like, oh, okay. Like, yeah, that's fine. Whatever.
Wow.
I remember
if someone I was dating told me I couldn't sing, it's curtains.
Yeah. I was just grateful that someone was interested in talking to me for the most part. I was pretty dorky, so I was like, cool, that's, you're fine. But I remember this crazy, that she actually told her father that I could not sing, and then her father happened to tell my father
that,
that I couldn't sing, and then my father comes to me and he's like, did she tell you that you can't sing? And I was like, yeah. And he was like, you can sing. You can learn how to sing if you feel like you need to work on
of
it.
Course.
Like anybody, like I think he used Janet Jackson as an example. He was like,
yeah,
yeah. And he's like,
she has a really unusual voice and it's like magnetic.
Yeah. And so he was like, you can, like, if she can do it, you can do it. He was always the approach mm-hmm. that like he would always just tell me anything that I could set my mind to, I can accomplish. And I really do think that having that mindset was very fundamental to me being able to accomplish anything in my life. So,
oh my gosh. Yes. I just reluctantly made a TikTok this morning about how we sometimes have to give it up for dads because a can-do attitude actually does change your outlook on life.
Totally.
And like elbow grease does go a long way. Like, okay, thanks, dad.
Totally.
Back to your path towards this record that we're kind of charting.
Mm-hmm.
Full disclosure, I also am a Black graduate of a fancy boarding school at which I had a full scholarship. So
nice, yeah.
Let's talk about boarding school.
Yeah. So I actually did not attend. It was not a boarding school specifically. It was mm-hmm. just a private school that
you were
You
were a day student, right?
Exactly. Got it. Yeah. So.
Yeah. Prep school.
More
sorry. Generally,
yeah,
I guess.
There you go. Yeah.
So what did the Academy teach you about people's expectations for you?
I guess the biggest thing, one of the first lessons that my father kind of really just explained to me at a very young age was that I was going to be treated differently as I got older. Mm-hmm. That I was not going to be viewed as the cute little Black kid forever.
Mm-hmm.
And
early would you say you talked about that with your dad?
Probably. My dad was a little premature. He was pretty harsh about like just giving it to me real at a young age. So I was probably like 5 or 6 years old.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, of course I just was like, I don't believe that, whatever. Because I was like, what considered probably one of the most kind and respectful kids at the school or whatever, you know? And I took, I guess I took pride in that. So I was like, well, what would they have on me at that point? But mm-hmm. As time did shift, obviously that did change a little bit. I think the biggest lesson I learned was when the institution of the school made its attempts to try to protect like the black students as best as they could, but really fundamentally an environment like that is going to have heavy like segregation based off of just like your economic status. So I obviously didn't have much money, so then I would often go over to my friends' places and they would have these beautiful houses, and obviously I would choose to go and hang out at their places instead of my house.
Of course.
You know. But then that created a whole dynamic where my father would be like, well, I don't want you only thinking that is what life is, and coming home to realize that we were so different from that. So those were some of the base lessons that I learned just attending the school. Education-wise, it was phenomenal. I can't deny that. I mean, when it comes to just resources, of course, mm-hmm. I was told by my best friend's brother that had attended, he was 7 years older than us, and he had also attended, and my best friend was also a scholarship student. His family was immigrants from Brazil. And
solidarity.
There was some solidarity with that. And he told us at a very young age to take advantage of all of the resources there to the fullest extent. And so we did. And that's kind of where I was just like, yeah, I guess not every school has a fucking pottery wing. Like, not every school has, like, orchestra.
No, dude, I went to New Zealand backpacking on the school's dime in high school. Like, these are the types of resources that any kid should have.
Totally.
And they can be so... I mean, to be able to have the chance to, like, let your imagination take flight, develop an interest, and then have every resource to pursue it is kind of intellectually, like, life-changing.
It really is. And so I got to experiment. I got to experience. I had friends, families that were willing to take me snowboarding. I couldn't afford a snowboard. Right. I know how to snowboard now. I can... I got experiences to, I got to study in China. I had a family, like a friend that paid for a trip for a, like, we were doing a class trip, a Chinese class trip to go to China. There's no way I was able to pay for that. There was no situation that would have worked. And I got that sorted and I got that opportunity and experience. So, those are, I can't take that lightly. Now, what came with that often felt this pressure to deliver with these expectations, like with these opportunities. And I guess, like, I don't know, it depends on how you look at it. Of course, if I was given all this opportunity, I would obviously want to optimize as much as I possibly can. But especially coming out of high school, trying to figure out what the next phase of life was, that was the most difficult situation for me, because all the options and perspectives that I was previously presented were from the lens that I could afford to go to these colleges or go to these schools, right? Because everybody else
can. And then it's a reality check when your peers are just sending out 30 applications and they have their pick, and it's based on, like, where can I get in?
Yeah.
It's different for us.
Yeah. And it took me a while to figure that out. And I just wanted, for a long time, I just wanted to make a decision that would get people off my back so they wouldn't be concerned, basically. And I there was a small ounce of me that wanted to try to go to music school, but I knew how that would be perceived. So I just was like, I'm not gonna even go that, liberal arts or nothing, basically. Any, like, hippie alternative style school was not going to, I even had my college counselor present some of those, and I just turned them down because I was just like, I don't think that that's going to be enough for these people to feel. There's going to be heavy judgment. And
You mean by, like, your peers and their families?
Mostly their families, because I ended up having a reputation at that school where I wasn't, like, the best student, but I was still somebody that represented, I was the, like, a class representative, basically.
Yes.
As since I started from kindergarten to 12th grade, I was, like, their big experiment, basically. So that was what was weighing on me a bit. So, but I always knew I wanted to do music and be an artist and creative. And I just kept trying to figure out lanes that I could stay creative, because everything else felt very just bleak to me. I ended up trying to go.
Yeah, so what did you do next?
I'm
so curious where the story's going. Because I just feel so much compassion and so much resonance, even though we grew up in different parts of the country. Just there are so many little moments and questions that I've had to ask myself in the same way, you know, a few years prior.
Exactly. I started to recognize that it is a collective experience that a lot of, like, Black youth go through, that getting,
especially those of us who get the sense that we are part of the talented 10th and certain things are expected of us from our own communities, from the country, from the great experiment of democracy. Like, there's a lot of pressure on quote unquote talented Black youth who get access to elite spaces. But
that's right.
More on my term paper on that later.
No, that's exactly it. That's so real. So prior to me leaving high school, I came up with this idea with my friend to create an artist hub website that would take young artists. I'd go and interview them. I'd connect them with other artists and like basically try to create like a social media app for artists in high school and college to connect together, basically. Mm-hmm. And it became a thing for a minute, and I used that as leverage to get into schools, basically, because my grades didn't reflect what I was trying to accomplish, basically.
So you did the liberal arts thing.
I did. I ended up picking a liberal arts school. I went there for one semester, and I was very depressed. And I went to school for business and entrepreneurship because I was like, all right, I don't know, I guess something that will convince people that I'm trying to do something. And I felt like that was one way I could stay creative. I was there for the semester, realized I couldn't afford it, and then realized that I was also, I mean, I was realizing that I was not happy there. And so that when I realized, like, that realization of not being able to afford it, I just left. And then I went back home, really just was like, I'm not sure what to do. I don't want to go and try to do the same thing somewhere else, basically, which I had plenty of people that were over my shoulder asking that.
I believe that.
And so basically I ended up meeting my current partner, and she convinced me that I could just focus on music because she believed in me. Of course, I was just like, that's crazy. And
hell yeah.
And then I just ran away to New York, basically, and hid in New York until and just like worked at my craft and met as the people that I could. And yeah, that was kind of it for the most part. I mean, there's a lot of other parts to that, but I can get
imagine.
Yeah.
But that is that's a folk tale.
Yeah.
I'd love to dig into the album.
Yes.
The Academy. So you played pretty much every instrument on this album, and my big picture impression of it is that every sound on the record is super intentional.
Yes.
So can you talk about what it was like, both vibe-wise and practically in terms of workflow, recording this album? I know you worked with my buddy Jake Aaron.
Oh, you know Jake? Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We worked together on the most recent Domino Kirk album.
Okay, yeah, you know Domino too. Cool.
Yeah. Yeah, I play in her band when she I wish she would play a million more shows because her music is just like, it's like a cocoon opening into a precious moth.
That makes that's very on brand for Domino. That makes sense. Yeah. That's cool.
So can you talk about your relationship with Jake, the environment in the studio, the workflow? Like, how did you make the sounds on this record?
Yeah, so one, Jake is a brilliant engineer and producer, and I got connected to him through my label, Windspear, that I was working on for this record, and he instantly stood out because I was really obsessed with the Grizzly Bear albums, and he worked on many of those albums, right? And that was the amount.
Hi, Chris.
Yeah, hi, Chris. Respect to you guys. And I just really needed somebody that could capture me well. That was really it. Like, I knew that if I was in a studio with resources and space, I could do something well. And I just kind of trusted Jake's insight. We decided on recording at Sonic Ranch and at boarding El Paso. And yeah, I came to him with a bunch of junk, basically, just like half songs and stuff. That I when I make my demos, especially when going into album, I purposely make them pretty bad so that I don't get attached to the sound of them. So there's always something to improve on.
Yeah. And demo-itis is so real.
It's very real. So I showed him a bunch of stuff that sounded like absolute garbage, basically. So he's like, yeah, there's kind of something here, but you need to like still finish a lot of stuff. And we had 10 days of recording to complete 14 songs that I was supposed to play everything on. So he's coming into it feeling like, this is a really daunting task. I don't know how we're going to accomplish this. I think it was stressing him out because, of course, he was like, I have contractually, I need to get 14 songs out of you, and you didn't bring you didn't bring a band either, so everything's 100% on you. And I was just
did you feel the pressure? What, how were you feeling going into it?
Well, I felt confident, but then there was the, I didn't expect the level of like hyper precision that Jake was going to request out of me. And so when it came to us starting to track, and he was like, no, that was slightly off. That was slightly off. Get it right. It took me back to engaging with my father in music. And my father's also very hypercritical and strict about just being getting it right.
Are we talking mostly about like playing to a click, expressing a phrase correctly, like anything?
Everything. So there would be times where I'd play perfectly to click, but I bent the strings slightly or was like half a second off or something like that. He was very specific and particular about that. And I was able to appreciate it, but I was also just feeling, it just like kept beating me down as I was going through that process of being like, dang, I really, like, I've never really claimed to be a good instrumentalist, but in this situation, I have to be a good instrumentalist.
Yes.
So it took quite a few takes for certain instruments. Drums were hard because I was still writing parts while also recording. Yeah. And so I knew what was it was supposed to be. Jake was having to trust me. And that was just like the hurdle that we were going through. And every day it ended up being 12 to 14 hour days of recording and writing on the spot. There'd be things, moments where he'd be like, hey, this needs a bridge or something, like, or something different here. Yes. This needs to be changed. And that's where I actually excel in the creative process. And that's why I keep incomplete ideas, is because on the spot, a lot of the time I will come up with my best work.
Well, yeah, if you're a hip hop kid, it's really nice to be in the room with someone you respect and maybe is slightly in conflict with you, who is going to challenge you to do something new right now.
Yeah.
I totally see that for you.
Yeah. So I can't freestyle hip hop yet, but or like rhyme or anything like that. But I apply the same process to songwriting. I feel like that's my true skill. I'm not a crazy musician or instrumentalist. I can accomplish it. I mean, I can accomplish the ideas that I need to accomplish. This is something that I'm continuing to catch up to, because that's kind of just the journey that I'm on, I suppose. So
totally. Can we talk about Broken Twin?
Yeah.
Correct me if I'm wrong. What it feels like to me is a meditation on cycles. The lyric, like, a walk of life, cropped by the scythe, would you revive me? What does the narrator of this song, or the speaker of the song, have to say about time and repetition?
So...
Yeah,
so the conversation that I'm having in that song, to me, is a conversation with a universal power or something like that. Mm-hmm. Whether people want to associate that with a god or whatever, I don't... That's not really the point. The point is there's a conversation with the act of consciousness and the cycles that we recognize that we're kind of living through, I suppose. And so it's more of a conversation of... maybe a little bit of resentment, irritation, anger, pain with this universe, this realm, this it's like a direct communication to an internal self and an external self simultaneously.
Interesting.
That's kind of the lane that I'm taking creatively for that. So a lot of it is just coming to terms with this existence being something both simple and complicated. And obviously the conscious mind it's really easy to complicate things where it doesn't need to be, and easy to oversimplify things that
that's the other side of the coin. Do you have a meditation practice?
I think the act of writing and creativity is my meditation practice.
Yes.
I think when I am in a process of flow, like just general flow. I'm not mm-hmm. trying to write anything. I'm just seamlessly letting like an energetic creative process flow through me. That is when I feel most in tune with myself and my body. So,
yeah. Okay. This is a little wacky, but speaking of like artistic meditative processes, I do a lot of like scribbling and coloring books and things when I need to slow my brain down. And I've listened to your album in so many different settings, like walking, sitting. This morning I listened to it like at dawn while coloring.
Wow.
And I made this illustration kind of inspired by the bed.
Cool.
And this was before I saw the visualizer on Spotify.
Nice.
So it's just hearing the song. This is what I made.
Wow.
So it's just like little textures in a quilt.
That's beautiful.
With kind of a black and brown wavy field in the middle.
Yeah, I love that.
So then I went on my computer and looked at the visualizer and I was like, I feel like we're onto a similar
frequency
theme about patterns in nature, kind of playing with scale. You think about like a bag of grain versus a bag of marbles.
Yes.
This is all very impressionistic, but can you talk about what textures you infused this record with? How does texture show up, especially with the way that you work as a drummer and a rhythm guitarist?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think something that I'm always trying to dive into is something that evokes, that does not feel two-dimensional. We're in a third-dimensional realm. So with that being the case, I want the music to remind us of that. And that's kind of the most important thing. The symbolism around this project was the tetrahedron. And that is a symbol of fire. It's a symbol of just power, energy. And I wanted to be able to have that being like the root of the feeling. So that meant textures that felt very earthly, I wanted to make sure that there was a feeling that was grounding, that made you feel rooted. It hits you to the core. There's no flimsy plastic. I mean, these are all terms that I use that are arbitrary, but like just.
No, but I get what you're kind of describing two different types of
Of like felt textures. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Textures. So I needed something to feel very organic. So it's the base of all of the songs needed to have a root of organic, whether that was metallic textures, whether the drums had to feel kind of like a literal mineral or a rock or something. I often associate to colors or organic material. And then layered on top of that, I wanted an ethereal feeling that felt very heavenly or spacey, to create that duality between earth and the ether, and that's what I'm trying to capture.
I have a question about the album that you can feel free to like take a second and decline if you would like to.
Yeah.
So the word visceral comes up a lot when people write about this album.
Yeah.
My impression is that that's not just because the music is so arresting, but it's also because, you are bringing a physicality to the music, and oftentimes your subject matter are experiences that are felt and experienced in the body, like experiencing violence and loss, homelessness, which is also a kind of violence.
Yeah.
So what does it feel like in your body to perform these songs on stage? And do you do any self-care to ground yourself around these vulnerable performances?
I think the act of self-care is really hard for me because I have conditioned or been conditioned to kind of ignore a lot of my signals, like food, water. I'm like constantly hungry, dehydrated, and just either overstimulated. And the best way I can kind of survive, especially on the road, is just to try to like numb out and just like turn my brain off basically as much as possible. I don't think I've found that balance quite yet. I think I'm still working that out. And hopefully as I gain more self-control and direction to when I'm touring and how I'm performing and the settings that I accept as okay enough for me to be playing in, that will change, hopefully. When it comes to live performance, I want it to be something that feels visceral is a good word to describe it, but really there's a lot of artists and throughout history that I feel like tapped into something that was more than just a performance. It was an expression, and that goes with dance and music. And the way that I approach even recording music, it is at the very first a personal moment of expression. And so if it starts to feel like I'm just playing the songs, that is that's painful to me. And I only, so I try to make every show feel as powerful as I feel when I'm listening to the songs. And that depends sometimes on the live mix, and there's only so much I can do about that, but I'm very affected by that. And there's definitely been shows where I've played and it just sounds, it's just not working for me. It's not hitting me well. And it's really hard to dig in and really properly perform. So that's something that I'm wrestling with. And it's a process, honestly. So.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. I only know what I know, but I found on my most recent tour, a little hack was like, changing, like really focusing on what shoes I wore on stage, like so that I knew exactly how I was going to be standing at the mic. Like there's a million different like ways you can get closer to feeling like sustainable on stage. Like I just know you're gonna get there.
Exactly. And so I mean, I think I'm still figuring out, I'm still pretty new playing with a band. And
that, what's your band lineup on the road?
It's ever changing right now. I think I'm in a process of still figuring out the people that help convey the songs the way that I'm looking for. Also aligns up with other people's availability. I've got a lot of artists that are also doing their own projects. I'm not a, like, I want everybody to be happy in doing what they're doing. So I will not tell people that they should sacrifice on their own opportunities on my behalf. So I'm still figuring that out, but everyone that I've played with is immensely talented and, great at their craft. So I've felt like I've been in good hands, but yeah, right now I'm still in that process of figuring out everything, live, really. I think I really want to try to make a three piece feel as full and powerful as possible. And, and so far I've gotten good reception and it feels strong and good to me as well. So.
Oof, a power trio is hard to beat. I just have one more question and then a lightning round.
Okay.
If you're down.
Yes, definitely.
So talk to me about Vermont. What are your days like? What is your home like?
Yeah, so I live up a mountain in the woods, in a tiny house on a plot of land. It's most of my days, at least leading into winter, is just making sure that my water is not freezing. I'm kind of always trying to fix stuff, especially like plumbing and just insulation. Like obviously it gets really cold out here, and in the winter I'm always fighting condensation buildup and then mold. If that's, I mean, that's just living in these cold places, especially if I'm heating the house very intensely, it creates like a pressurized box basically. And then the cold air from the ground just starts to collect in the corners. And so I have to kind of figure out how to make sure there's a airflow that doesn't, it's just like stuff like that I'm constantly mapping out.
Deeply practical and also cosmic.
Exactly. And so that's a lot of my day to day. I have a neighbor that's not very far from me that has a studio that that I'm actually currently in, that I work out of, and she's just a great friend of mine, and we have like a pretty mutual connection where I just help her out and mm-hmm. and in the studio, and she helps me a lot too. So yeah, it's quite peaceful up here for me, and very grounding. And other than that, I just am doing, I work under my partner's father, who's an architect, design and builder, and he's also a carpenter. And so I've been learning carpentry and building from him. So we've been working on some projects, one, their house that we're building and milling ourselves, and then two, a studio that we're working on that is timber framed. So we are doing wood joinery, precision wood joinery, like a lot of traditional like Japanese wood joinery techniques as well. So
We're gonna need to see pics when these projects are complete.
Totally Yeah, I'm
we'll follow up with you.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, this is gonna be an ongoing process, of course, but yeah, I'll be building my own studio ideally, and house as well. So it's just given time and budget and everything, that's kind of how it has to work, you know?
That's how it all has to work. Okay. Mm-hmm. Lightning round.
Yeah.
What venue or festival, big or small, is on your bucket list?
I'd probably say, Red Rocks seems interesting. To be so honest, I don't really have many bucket list goals in general. I really am kind of along for the ride for the most part, but, I think more importantly to me is being part of events or lineups or shows that feel culturally important. And I think that's my biggest goal and experience thing. A focus is that I just want to be part of the general conversation of music, artistry of this time period very deeply. And that's constantly changing too. So yeah. I it's hard for me to pin down what that is.
We'll do some easy ones.
Yeah.
Name a movie you love.
A movie that I love. I've always kind of had an obsession with Scott Pilgrim versus the World.
What is your favorite beverage?
My favorite beverage, banana strawberry smoothie.
Mm-hmm. What's your favorite season?
Autumn.
Who is your celebrity crush?
Don't really pay attention to celebrities. I don't really care about celebrities.
Who is your nemesis?
The fucking, I don't know, the world powers or something. I don't know.
For sure.
Oppression.
What do you want done with your body when you die?
Just put it in the ground if it's not hurting anybody, and don't hyperfixate on like memorializing anything.
If I met you in kindergarten and then we lost touch, so my only memories of you were Lutalo at 5 to 6 years old, what are three adjectives that I might use to describe you to others?
I was very open. I was distracted, and curious would also be, yeah.
Fabulous. Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for pivoting to the call and, you know, dealing with all of our tech stuff, because I am just so into this record and I'm so glad we got to talk about it.
Oh, thank you so much, Lizzie. I really appreciate it. Yeah, this has been fun.
This episode of Basic Folk was produced by CJ Nungesser. Good buddy Dietrich Strauss composed our theme song and segue music. Basic Folk is a production of the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network. You can find all of our episodes there. You can search for Basic Folk on the SiriusXM app. You can go to folkalley.com or check out Folk Alley's mobile app. Go to our website, basicfolk.com, or wherever you listen to your shows or podcasts, because they're starting to call podcasts shows.
Can I plug something here at the end of the episode?
Oh, absolutely. I wish you would.
As of the recording of the show, I have just put out a new song. It's called Banks of the Rio Grande. It's a live recording from the legendary Hideout Inn in Chicago. You can get it at lizzyno.bandcamp.com.
We'll put that link in the show notes. Don't you worry. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with a friend. Maybe share it with someone who could be offended by this episode. Who might be offended by this episode?
Who knows? That's a fun prompt.
Or the people that were all about that Kamala is for they, them.
Yeah, that's a confusing sentence, and I feel offended.
I'm offended by the grammar.
I'm deeply offended. Love you, Lilas.
Love you. Cheers.